tu sahanau bhunaktu sahaviryam karavavahai tejasvi navahitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is eternally different from the individual souls and from matter. However, the souls and matter are not different from Bhagavan. This is a great secret. So then, farther down. Now, the Vijnana part, Bhagavan teaches, I am the Supreme Truth. When the souls perceive only what is outside me, then they cannot perceive my true nature. That is because of the influence of my potency. That potency is called by the name of Maya. When it is manifested in spirit, that potency is called Yoga Maya. My potency is eternally... No, okay. So, seeing Krishna is that when you only perceive what is outside of me, because Krishna has made this point that he is there, but what is the value, right? Because this is the Vijnana element. Mm-hmm. What is the value, then that is what you're looking for. So, the point is what's the value is here. So when you're looking for what's outside of that, then that'll be Maya. When you don't look outside of that, that's Yoga Maya. So in the spiritual world, Yoga Maya is manifest. In the material world, then Mahamaya is manifest. Right? Because people don't see that it's Krishna that's the attractive element. My potency is eternally different from me and not different from me. How it is not different from me is not easily seen. How it is different from me is easily seen. It is different from me in two ways. As a reflection, abhasa, and as darkness, tama. Here, abhasa refers to the individual souls, and tama refers to the material world. Thus, the individual souls and the material world are both my potencies. That should be known. Okay. Okay, so he's saying is how they're different, that's easy to see, because you can see two entities. How they're not different, that's what's difficult. So the Maya is darkness. So darkness just means not having light. Mm-hmm. Right? Does that make sense? So the negative quality is not actually different from the positive quality, it's just lacking the positive quality. Like that. So it's quite a subtle thing. We'll say, oh, it's so different. No, but it's in the same category. It's the same thing, it's just whether it's there or not there. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, it's just like, let's say you have a pot for rice. Then you can say it's full of rice, or it's half full of rice, or it's very little rice, or there's no rice. But you don't have another, it's not another thing. It's no rice just means that the rice is not there. You understand? But it's all about rice. Yes. You know? Does that make sense? Like that. So, yeah, does that make sense? I mean, so empty means no rice. Right? So then, yeah, and then as reflection, abhas means it's the potency of the Lord. So that's you have the reflection, but at the same time as they are individual souls. Right? But reflection is that they have the similar nature, they have the similar, all these other aspects of the Lord. But in very minute qualities. Just like if you have the sun and it's reflected in pots of water, using that example that the impersonalists will use. The point is you can get unlimited pots, but they're small, right? So they only are manifest according to the size of the pot, right? While the sun is, you know, original and unlimited. Right? So the souls will be small. Right? But at the same time as What is the nature of the sun, and what's the nature of the reflection? Right? Basically, same form, same. They both give light. Just one is very great, one is very small. Right? So the Lord is Satchitananda unlimitedly. The soul is Satchitananda in a very small way. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So that's how that oneness is there. But at the same time, they are different, because it's not just that it's a reflection, meaning that the reflection doesn't exist. That's how the Maya body is used. It's just a reflection, so it's not real. But there is such a thing as a reflection. Right? Does that make sense? A reflection is a noun. It's an entity. Does that make sense? The next stage of knowledge of Bhagavan and his potencies, is called Vijnana. In the third part, the Rahasya part, the next stage of knowledge.
The first sentence probably would have worked better at the end of the previous paragraph.
Yes, probably. Or it's probably this, I mean, it's this. Or this would, or the in the opening of the last paragraph,
yeah,
it would have been better. Can that be? Okay. In the third part, the Rahasya part, Bhagavan teaches the Pradhan Mahat and the material elements, beginning with earth, enter the material world, and at the same time they do not enter. In the same way, I, Bhagavan, the spiritual son, enter the individual souls, but still I am different from them eternally. That means the example is given of how the material world enters into all the different things, but it's different. Just like earth is in this rock. This rock is only made of earth, but this rock isn't the earth. Right? This earth is still a whole nother manifestation. You know, just like you have water in a glass. It is water, but you can't say this is the ocean. Right? The ocean is different. It acts differently. It has all, in other words, you have all the qualities of the water in the cup, and the water in the ocean are the same. And beyond that, the ocean has more. So that's the whole thing, is that Krishna, he enters into the creation. He has made everything. He's there before, he's there during, he's there after. He is what is of value there. He's what everyone's looking for. Like that, so he pervades everything, he knows everything, he controls everything, then him as a person is still beyond that. It's not that comprises him.
Mm-hmm.
He's still independent beyond that. Just like the earth is independent beyond this rock. So in the same way, Krishna is independent beyond these first two manifestations. That's a very important element. Because otherwise people get he's beyond or he's involved, but not that he's involved and beyond. That's the achintya aspect. Right? Mm-hmm. He is everything, at the same time he's different from everything because he's the source of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Mark? In the example where it says these elements, pradhan, etc., enter the material world, material world being referred to there, is that like the center of the Brahmanda and the elements making the coverings, or is there a reservoir of the elements beyond those coverings?
Well, here it's meaning they enter the material world. That would mean the manifestation that you see, like what we'd say here, this is the material world. So Pradhan, Mahat, and the material elements are beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where they're situated, just like means we're taking the greater, you know, just like I say. Okay. So, means I was using a smaller example. Means if you want to use a bigger example, it means then Pradhan is all the elements, the total elements. So even you have some of the elements, they are not the total elements. Right? Then Mahat means the element where you have that becomes alive, it becomes the aspect of everything becomes separated and all that. That potency of that time element, that false ego, all those different elements there, the Vasudeva Sattva, it's still beyond whatever manifestation is here. Right? Or you can say the primary creation is beyond. It means just because, it means there's the original, let's say, as we're saying, pillar. And even though there may be millions of pillars here, it still does not, they still do not comprise the original pillar. The original pillar is still separate. It's still there. It's just, and then you make, just like, let's say, you have a a blueprint of an apartment complex, right? And so in Russia, they'll take that one blueprint and make apartments like that all over Russia. So there'll be thousands and thousands of the exact same building, right? But still, that blueprint is still there. It's still separate from everything else, you know. And then the material elements, then they, you have the total material of the elements once they've separated. So you have the layers of earth, water, fire, air, ether around the Ramanda. And then inside you have some of those are manifest. So how much is required to manifest whatever at what time, that's how much is there. And the rest of it is in its store. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's just bringing out the point is that Krishna can enter everything and still be himself completely, complete in himself separate. Not that it's part of him's here and so, you know, he's missing a foot this time. He says, I told you to mind about that. Not that. You know, like that. You know, so it doesn't work that way. Yeah. In the same way, I, Bhagavan, the spiritual son, enter the individual spiritual souls, but I'm still different from them eternally. So he's entered them as Paramatma, but he's still different. Right? Like that. When the individual soul becomes my devotee, interesting theory, so he enters the individual spiritual soul, because we have the understanding of Paramatma as, you know, sitting there with the soul, so he's the size of the thumb or 1/10,000 the tip of the hair, but the point is he's also entered the soul. So he, as Paramatma, is inside the 1/10,000 of the tip of the hair. That's why he said smaller than the smallest. We're the smallest. So when we say the smallest, that means the jivas. But he's smaller than the smallest. He enters into each one of them. My devotee, when an individual spiritual soul becomes my devotee, then I become his friend. That is the great secret. So even though all these different elements are there of the tattva, at the same time as he is becomes friends. He has all this greatness and the small, all these different things. But the important point to him is the friend. Why the friend is brought up here? Because in the first two, you're dealing with how he's entered into everything, how he's controlling everything, you know, and how the difference between what the external matter and him. But now he's saying it's even though he enters and he does all this, still as a person he's separate, and if you become his devotee, he becomes your friend. That's the secret. Mm-hmm. Otherwise you just think, okay, he's God and he just remains there. Mm-hmm. You know, like that position, and you do something wrong, he becomes upset, and you do something right and then things go okay. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's still working on the Paramatma level. Mm-hmm. But this is that he's beyond all that godness as a person. Mm-hmm. And you deal with him as a person, as a devotee, then he becomes your friend. He reciprocates as a friend. Mm. Right. So that's the secret. Right? In the Taranga part, Bhagavan says, quote, when tormented, the sufferings of the world of birth and death, an individual soul takes shelter at the feet of a saintly devotee and inquires from him about the spiritual truth. Then, by his spiritual master's mercy, that soul searches for me directly and indirectly. Eventually, he attains me. In this way, Srimad Bhagavatam... Okay, so, in other words, here's the process. Now, here's the three aspects of Godhead and the understandings of the uniqueness and the oneness and difference of these three aspects, and the oneness and difference between the Lord and his energies, and how he, beyond this, acts as a devotee. So, this individual soul, when they take shelter of the spiritual master, then they search for Krishna in all these different aspects, in the direct and in the indirect. In other words, Bhagavan is the direct, Brahman and Paramatma is the indirect. So in all aspects, because everything that you once involved in is all having to do with Krishna. So even just the most ordinary activities in one's day-to-day life, still the potency of that, the value in that, that's still Krishna. What you're looking for is still Krishna. How it operates is still Krishna. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? How it's organized is still Krishna. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not that, oh, it's not direct aspects of devotional service, so it's not Krishna. No. Direct aspects are directly Krishna. These ones then are Krishna in the Brahman and Paramatma features. So they are Krishna, but they don't have that same personal aspect. But it's him, the person who's doing it. So if you're a devotee, even in these aspects, you relate to him as the person, and he relates to you in that way. Does that make sense? Eventually he attains me. In this way, Srimad Bhagavatam explains the truth of Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva, the inconceivable simultaneous oneness and difference of Bhagavan and the individual spirit soul. So you can see this Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. This is when it was asked, what's the essence of the Veda? And Krishna gave Brahma the Chaturshloki. He was giving him Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. It's just not necessarily appreciated, right? So, therefore, there is only Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. Now, if you take just the, the Abheda aspect, you get the Advaita, right? You take the Beta aspect, you get Dwait, right? Take them both, you know, separately, you get Dwait Advait, right? You take both of them, but lean more towards the Advait, then you get the Vishishta Dwait, Vishuddha Dwait, right? But its natural position, the natural Vedic position, is Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. Mm. So that's why generally it's kind of like experienced, you could say, by the members of the Vedic culture. Those who are, you know, serious members of the culture will experience this. Though they may never have thought about it or may never not be able to articulate it. And when you ask them about it, they may come up with all kinds of strange and wonderful things. But the whole idea is how something is, you know, you have the demigod there, you have, you know, who's managing things at the same time, the element that you're dealing with, at the same time, the deity, at the same time, your prayers to them, at the same time, you know, the mechanics of the material energy, managing it all at once. There's a kind of unspoken understanding that it's all happening at once. It's all the same and different, but they don't actually understand that. You know what I'm saying? Then they come up with all their other philosophies. Mm-hmm. But the culture is working because of this common experience. Does that make sense? Right. But Lord Chaitanya then articulated it, brought it out exactly. So that one can appreciate it and apply it directly. And, you know, therefore, it's not just based on the sentimental. So that sentimental element of the Vedic culture that works and is attractive to all the Hindus is this aspect. But it's the essence. So the essence is what's the attraction. But, unfortunately, they don't understand that that's what's the attraction. So then sometimes they'll even oppose when it's presented properly. You know, you say Achinta, no, it's all one, no, it's different. It's like, no, but the whole thing that you're doing, that I'm experiencing at the same time, I'm different from it. You know, Krishna's involved in it, at the same time he's different as the person. That means they're not catching that's Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So in other words, Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva is the Vedic philosophy. There isn't another. These others are derivatives of that. In other words, you're studying part of it. Right, just like Buddhi Yoga is the first chapters of Gita, right? You take 2 through 6. That's Buddhi Yoga, right? And the technicalities of how you apply it is, you know, then 13 through 18, right? And who you're applying that on is in the middle chapters, right? So it's one thing. But to study it, you study 3rd chapter karma, 4th chapter jnana, like this. Right? So in other words, somehow or another, 3rd chapter has been made into a philosophy. Right? So with the karma bhat, you know, the karma yoga philosophy. You know, and then the next one is the jnana yoga philosophy. Right? And they're opposed to each other. But somehow or another, the 5th chapter saying, no, we're all the same here. Right? And the 6th chapter saying, yes, but that's all, you know, kind of, then there's the meditation. And in this way they're fighting, but it's one thing. So in the same way, all these different sapada, all the different lines, it's all one thing. They're only taking parts of one thing. And because of those parts, they think that it's different. So they're only catching the difference, not the oneness. Yes. Because even the Maya bodies are catching the difference, because there's a no, it's Vaishnavism, and what they're saying is different. But if everything's one, what would be the difference? Yes.
On that note, earlier in the Tapuyuve, Bhaktivinoda Thakur comments on the directly and indirectly as corresponding to karma, which is the positivism, and the gyan, which is the skepticism. So he's saying that the anvaya and the vyatireka account for these deviations.
Okay, so the oneness and the direct and indirect, that's what causes deviations. Yeah. So if it's done improper under the shelter of the spiritual master, then it doesn't cause that.
Yeah. Well, the knowledge can take those two forms.
Oh, okay. Okay. So then, the direct will be the form, the indirect will be the subtle.
Yeah.
And so then, okay, so the direct becomes just the form. They only see the form without Krishna. And the other, they only see the subtlety, the Brahman, or these elements without the form.
Yeah.
So you get the Mayavad and the...
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So that's how your deviations
come. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's why it always comes out as karma and gyan.
Yeah.
Because he says that one of the points in Tatpavivek is that in the material world, the only philosophy that's there is karma and gyan. And then another point he says, all there is that there's Vaishnavism and Advaitavad. And so this Advaitavad then takes two forms, karma and gyan, like that. So all materialists are Advaitavadis, but just some of them lean towards karma, some of them towards gyan. Right, so some towards the direct, some towards the indirect.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because the direct is that personal, okay, the Supreme Lord Himself, like that, and then the indirect will be how He pervades everything and things like that. So you get into those natural forms or deviated forms. Okay, text 7. Jara jala gata jiva jara shaktim vihai cha svakya Vritim alochya sanakar labhate param. When the soul is caught in the trap of material life, renounce her attachment to matter, and then carefully engage in spiritual activities, then they attain the Supreme. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. The individual spirit souls may be divided into two groups. The soul is eternally imprisoned in the material world, nityabada, and the soul is free from that prison, nitya mukta. The eternally free souls are always attracted to serve Lord Krishna. When the soul is caught in the trap of material life, renounce her attachment to matter, and then carefully engage in spiritual activities. Eventually, they attain the supreme. Spiritual activities here means devotional service to Bhagavan, so that means carefully means under the direction of the spiritual master. As one engages favorably in devotional spiritual activities, one attains attachment from one's attachment from material things becomes gradually diminished. When those spiritual activities reach completeness and perfection, then attachment from material things becomes completely and perfectly eliminated. Then the individual spirit soul attains the feet of Bhagavan, the Supreme Truth, the Supreme Master of the spiritual world. As one again and again performs spiritual activities, one gradually finds them sweeter and sweeter. To the extent they are attached to matter, the individual souls remain averse to spirit. Because the attachment is one thing. Rasa is one thing. It's just a matter of where you apply it. Right? So it's either you're getting the taste from the spiritual, from the emotional, or from the sensual. This is how it is applied. So rasa is the same, the mechanics is the same, it's just where you apply it. So when under the direction of the spiritual master, one directs it towards Krishna, then gradually that one becomes purified, the taste increases, and then it becomes reconciled all nicely in Krishna. So then it's eliminated because it's fully engaged in one thing, there's no space for another. Right? Does that make sense? So it's just, so the idea is that when one is fully situated in Krishna consciousness, then everything will work very, very well because there is no material. So you're only seeing Krishna in everything. You're only seeing everything in connection to Krishna. So then being even here in the material world, you're not in the material world because you're in the spiritual world because you're only seeing spirit. Right? Material world means you only see matter.
Yes.
It's not so much the location because Krishna and his devotees and all, they also come here in this location. Mm-hmm. But they see spirit. Right? So they're in the spiritual world. Right? That's why I said, as they said, you know, wherever Lord Chaitanya is, that's Vrindavan. Right? So wherever the devotee is, that's Vrindavan. Because they see everything in connection to Krishna, so it's spirit. Mm-hmm. So matter, material means only seeing things in connection with matter. Yes.
And this way, the first step is to renounce, to detach from matter.
First step to detach from matter, but the first step in detaching from matter is to detach from the result. Yes. Right? Because yes. You make a decision based on your, samskaras, which means the experiences gained from effort. Right, so you have a position, you work with the field of activities, that then produces a result, that result produces the experience, that all moves back to Prajumna, part of Sambandha, right? So it becomes part of the identity, right? It means the experiential part of the identity. Then you have the false ego part of the identity, right? The ahankar. So in the process of contemplation or reasoning, I'm going to start with what is my field of activities and my experiences from that. I'm going to analyze it, but at the end I'm going to take my, my false ego is going to be the final point of decision making. Yes. Right? Does that make sense? So the whole thing is actually happening within Sambandha.
Yes.
Right? Because the other two is you're doing the activity and you're getting, and you're experiencing the result of that activity.
Yes.
So those aren't the identity, right? You may say, yes, I'm very good at doing things. But doing something, you can't think, I'm good at doing this, otherwise it won't work nice, right? So technically, if we look at it, trying to check means you say, I'm servant of Krishna. But where you focus on renunciation is on results. Not on your identity and your position and everything else there, because that's where you're situated.
Yes.
That's sat. That's where the eternal means your existence is.
Mm-hmm.
Though in the material world, in its perversion, it becomes ignorance,
mm-hmm.
right? Rather than situated in transcendence. Does this make sense? So in other words, technically, for the consciousness of the jiva, the result is something foreign, right? I want that means I don't have it.
Yes.
Right? And if I do have it, it's just part of me. But it's not what I'm endeavoring for. I'm not endeavoring for what I have.
Mm-hmm.
It's for what I don't have.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You understand?
Yes.
So you're going to say, no, but I'm using my stuff, but I don't have the phone call.
Yes.
I have a machine that can make phone calls, but I don't have the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
So the phone call's separate. So I use that machine to get the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the concept result is outside the jiva, right? Because the interaction is between the subject and the object and the verb.
Mm-hmm.
But the result is the dative. It's outside of these.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Yes.
And in here, whether we think of the subject, the object, or I'm the instrument, still the dative is outside. The result is outside. Does that make sense? Yes.
But the result being the experience, generally we associate the experience with the prayojana. So wouldn't that
yes,
kind of make the object, you know, equivalent to the experience? Just when we're talking about the three categories.
Yes, but the thing is you have to still be applying the effort onto something that's not the experience.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In other words, I'm applying the effort onto vegetables and pot and fire and spoon and,
yeah.
and spices, but that's not the cooked item.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It may become.
Yeah.
But the you know what I'm saying, through transformation. But the point is it's not now.
Okay.
So that's what I'm saying is because of that element, it's in one sense easy because the result is foreign to the living entity.
Yeah.
So giving that up is the easiest place to start.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But that's why we start there. We don't start with, you know, give up your house, give up this, give up your... You don't start there. Give up the results.
Yeah.
That's where you start. And when one is, because every of those results, those keep moving back into the samskara, means into the impressions. So they do that enough, now your impressions change, that my impressions are connected with devotional service rather than material life. Right? And because you're regularly doing that, then your identity as I am the master changes to I am the servant. So once that happens, then just by that process, then now when you look at things and identify things, now you're going to look at them from Krishna's point, you know, what's going to be good for Krishna. So you come to that Sarva Dharma Paritya Ja point. As opposed to, this is my conditioning, this is what I see, but I'll give the result up for Krishna. That's the difference that Krishna's talking about. Right? In the 18th point, the difference between this first 17 chapters and the 18th is the 18th is pointing out that there's a different way of looking at this. Right? The other ones just looks at, it's all about getting a result.
Yes.
Right? And so, and that getting that result's connected with me, with my conditioning. Right? I see the field, what conditioning, I mean by my conditioning, so that means I'll see the field in my own way, different from another living entity, because conditioning is different, right? That's why I make friends with someone with similar conditioning, because then when we look at something, we see a very similar thing.
Yes, yes.
You know? Does that make sense? Like that. So, yeah. So then, okay. So then, got to keep going there. Okay. Yes. So then, this different perspective. Then we're looking at Sakam and Nishkam, right? So I can do this, it's just for myself, but then I'm willing to give the result to Krishna. That's where we're starting from anyway. That matures into, you know, we're doing this, you know, and the result's already for Krishna, right? But it's still consideration of the conditioning, what I'm comfortable with, what services I'm comfortable doing. The other is just what's good for Krishna, right?
Yes.
And then looking at, so by the facility I have, that's the service I can do. I have this conditioning, so that's the kind of service I can run, rather than starting with the conditioning, but I'm using that just for Krishna. Right? So we see that there's basically two main aspects, renunciation and sannyas. Right? So within this, then that sannyas can have that, you're starting with the conditioning or you're not starting with the conditioning. Right? So this is then one's trying to give up that aspect. So, but all that is started with the result. So in the first one, it's mine, but okay, then I'll give it up. The next one, it's my conditioning. The result's Krishna, but the conditioning's mine. And the third one is it's just for Krishna.
Yes.
It's all about Krishna. Right? So result is always the point, but it's just a matter of how much the attachment is there to that material identity. Right? So the first is quite strong, the second it's very, very minimal, and the third there isn't any. So the common point is the result. That's the one thing that can be used all the way through. Does that make sense? So if that's always there and that's always consistent, then naturally, because Aniruddha always goes back to Prajumna, right? Results always go back to the field of activities. Right? You know, so one's desire, one's interest. So does that make sense? So if the desire is material, I get the material result, it moves back to the material desire, it just strengthens material desire.
Yes.
So the more I go and the more I'm successful, the more I'm confident about my material desire. Now, I'm not successful, nothing moves back there. There's nothing to feed the material desire. So one loses that confidence.
Yes.
And then one thinks, well, maybe there's something else, because that's connected with one's identity. So then one doubts one's identity as the supreme controller and enjoyer. Understand? So that's why this aspect, Krishna, by taking it away or making it difficult or not getting it, it just reduces material desire. And it changes, it naturally brings up a change in the identity. Right? Now, if you're doing these things in connection with Krishna, as they move from the Prayojana back into the Sambandha, right? Then your desire is always based on, is nourished by the spiritual results and spiritual endeavor. So that's going to change, you know, your first impression of things. Instead of, oh, hey, there's something for me, now it's something for Krishna. And the results at the end, yeah, I can do that, but I'm a servant of Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? So it's just, this is a very key thing. It's not just, yeah, give the results. No, this is the mechanics, how it works. You know, just like if we say, yeah, you get in the car and put the key in the ignition and turn it. You know, okay, but what about all the, no, but if you don't do this, the rest of it won't work. Yeah, well, that's, of course, it's simple, but what about all the, you know what I'm saying? And then you get in and they're going, hey, what's happening? Did you put the key in there? And, no. You know, so there's all these things, I'm doing this, I surrendered to Krishna and all that, but was the result for Krishna? You know what I'm saying? Because you can do so many things that are for Krishna. But whether you're seeing the result is for Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So when you change that, that's when everything else changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's why it's a very weak position if you're taking as a platform people's rights or morality, you know, or economics, you know, security, all these different things, because those are just the standard material things, our dharma, artha, kama, moksha, that everybody takes. So where is the spiritual element? Where's the spiritual aspect to it? Where's the result for Krishna? You know what I'm saying? If people have their rights, okay, but who are the rights about? The individual, not about Krishna. You understand? That's why in the Vedic system, what is etiquette for? Why is there Vaishnava etiquette? Right? Because everybody else has their rights. It's not your business to go in and lord it over the whole material energy. You have to respect other individuals. Right? That's etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? But if I say etiquette, Vaishnava etiquette, then people will just think, oh, it's just a little, you know, hey, vanchas, Prabhu, vanchas, you know, something like that. And that, you know, I'm behaving properly, that's morality, that's ethics, that's something solid. No, that's economic development. That's all it is. It never is any more glorious. You can use romantic language and it sounds better.
Mm-hmm.
But its point is just upfront economic development. That's it. It doesn't have, it's not, no, but that's most of the time, but listen that, or what devotees is, no, it's the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why that's not the presentation we use.
Yeah.
We use the presentation that shows the connection with Krishna. So therefore it's called Vaishnava etiquette.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? But if you just talk morals, then what morals? Whose morals? You know, we use Asian morals. We use, you know, Western morals. You can say, no, but the Western is leading the world. Just have a look around in any of these first world countries. Who's the up and coming and really leading, you know, has the most money, has the most positions and everything like that. And except for the few of the big, big main ones, the ones that are down the professional level, it's not white. No one should be fooled. It is Asian. Right? And you know, very much coming up behind, you know, with all the other third world, you know, countries. That's what it actually is. So, therefore, if we're going by majority and all that, then we should take Asian and, you know, South American, all the third world ethics and use those. If we're actually being real and sincere about our philosophy about Vox Populi. Because the point is, the Vox ain't white. So therefore, that's not the position you can take. Otherwise, then you have to say, this is my opinion, and my opinion is the world opinion. Then, okay. Then, you know, we'd have to respect that, you know, that one's truthfulness there, and one's commitment, and everything. But then we can discuss, okay, well, so how are you willing to accommodate everybody else? How do we all fit into your, you know, world view? Like that. But if you present it as this other thing, is no, this is the real, the, you know, this is the actual real, you know, culture and the real essence of, you know, human life, then it's just nonsense. they say. As Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur would say, Sarerdang. Means not know. Sarer gober. Right? Sar means bull. Right? Because the bull dung is not pure like the cow dung. So it's not used in any ceremonies. So the bull dung is useless. So that's what he said. When you come up with all these bogus things, he says it's just bull dung.
There's an expression for that in English, too.
Yes, there's also, there is a direct translation in English, but we're avoiding that at this particular point. But the point is that's what it is. It's just known in the Vedic culture, is that you have this form, right? It looks like, but there is no substance. So look, bull dung and cow dung look the same, right? It's made out of the same grass in this, but one has that purifying element and the other doesn't. So that means one's useful, one's useless. So that's the point. So what we're making is all these mundane approaches are useless. So, but the Vedic, it's the same thing. It looks the same, but it has the antiseptic. But because of the antiseptic, it has that pure quality, it's not as attractive. Right? The mode of goodness is not what's attractive. You know, motive, passion, ignorance is. Does that make sense? You know, because if I say rights, that means I can get what I want. If I talk about Vaishnav etiquette, what does that mean? I'll get what I want, but it means I have to actually make an endeavor to purify my life and deal properly. But that's not what people who are talking rights are talking about. They just want, without any qualification, just because I'm of that particular bodily designation, I'm a child, I'm an adult, I'm an, a worker, or I'm a this or that, whatever is your designating the rights for that particular group. Because I have that particular, physical or intellectual makeup, means from the gross and subtle body, I have that, therefore I deserve it. Not that I have to actually do any work. Vaishnav etiquette means it's a process, not an identity. While the others, it's rights, it's about my identity. And it's just someone else should do it and I should just get the results. You understand? So that's the fun part, is Vaishnav etiquette is actually superior because it's independent. Well, the modern concept is dependent, which is fun because they think it's the other way around. You know, I'm independent, I do what I want. No, you're not. You're completely dependent upon your social concept. Yes?
But what if one responded that even if you as an individual are performing all your duties and performing all the etiquettes nicely, someone can still infringe upon your rights, therefore there has to be an element of protecting?
Yes, but I'm saying my point is that why doesn't that come from God? Mm-hmm. How do you protect? What is the right? You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just like now. Let us say you have, maybe you've heard of this one case. A thief broke into the guy's house. And he thought no one was there. Then when the house owner came out, you know, I guess with a baseball bat or something, whatever it is, the guy jumped out of, you know, he came into the first floor and he jumped out one of the first floor windows. Mm-hmm. He broke his leg because he didn't realize on that side of the house there was a bigger drop. There was a slope. And so he broke his leg. He took the house owner to court that, you know, he broke his leg by jumping out of his window. You know, there was no sign there saying, you know, this is a dangerous drop or something. You know, it's like the cups of coffee. You buy a cup of coffee because it's hot, right? People complain if it's cold, you know? So by the same thing is that it doesn't say on there it's hot. So that if he gave you a cold cup of coffee, and they say, well, this is cold. It says, does it say on there hot? You know, does it say hot? No, it doesn't say hot. So why are you complaining it's cold? No, because coffee is supposed to be hot. And so if it's hot, and then you burn yourself because you're an idiot. You know, you try to hold the coffee dry and then get the keys and make a phone call at the same time. You drop it, you get burnt, then you sue them that it was hot, and you didn't say it was hot. This is like insanity. And that is coming from people's rights. So how is that protecting the right? Do you understand? Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's not defined by the actual harmonious universal laws. So how do you define what somebody's rights? So it comes down to whatever I can get away with, that's rights. And whatever I can't, I'll just keep trying. It's not, but the point is how do you define where's the limit of your rights in that? Because if we're talking rights, it means up to a limit. You can't keep going. Right? Because otherwise, how do you balance even that between the individual and the state? It has to be a balance. If the state's too much involved, then it's the individual's rights. But if the individual's too much involved, how is there a state? You know what I'm saying? You know, nobody wants to fight. Nobody wants to do anything. The government should do everything. But the government's made out of the citizens. So if no citizens are fighting, you know, in the war, then how do you protect the place? So that's all. It's that you have to have this balance. So how do you know what the balance is? Because in the Western culture, means in, or let's say in the non-Vedic culture, the problem is always this balance is wrong. Always. You know what I'm saying? You have the government, and then they consider it, you know, either too strong or too weak. The people rise up. They get, you know, get rid of everybody, you know, cut off everybody's heads and stick them on, you know, on the fence. You know, and then after that, then there's no government. And so then just, you know, whoever's the strongest comes in and takes over. Mm-hmm. So was that an improvement? Mm-hmm. You know, how was that an improvement? You know? 7 million people die over two generations of kings. Right? Two generations. The father and the son. Two generations. 7 million in wars by the country trying to protect borders or expand the borders into something that may not have been successful. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, you remove those people and then a new person comes in and within a very short few years, he's killed 30 million. How is that an improvement? How is that people's rights? That's the whole thing. So unless there's guidelines, because the thing is who knows how the universe works? God knows. He made it. So in other words, what we're saying is, no, we'll make up our own rules how this machine works. But you say, no, here's a nice manual here. Why should we listen to the manual? Now, you know, that was printed so long ago, and we're here right now, right today. We're going to make up the rules now. That's what we're actually talking about. Mm-hmm. If we present it like that, people go, well, and you know, of course that's stupid. But that doesn't apply to the situation. No, that perfectly applies. Because the thing is people don't know who they are, so how do you know what your rights are?
Well, yeah. That's the purpose of things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where they say everyone's entitled to education, clean drinking water, medicine, and shelter.
But that's the government is supposed to provide that. So why hasn't them been provided? You know, if we're talking about, you know, how you say 3,000 years of Western civilization, why would they have to make that? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Why would they have to do that? I mean, the Vedic concept, you have a war outside the city. Mm-hmm. Because the point is when you win the war, you're going to live in the city. So if you have a war in the city, then after the war, where do you live? Right? Up to even World War I, it was all fought outside the city. Mm-hmm. You just didn't have wars in the city because people live in the city. Besides World War II, then they have it in the city. Mm-hmm. When did they make that Declaration of Universal Rights?
Probably between World War I and World War II, around that time.
I think it was 48.
Yeah.
You know, so it's during World War II or at that time. So that's when they went off. Now, who went off? Who was fighting in the cities? Right? Who made the Universal Bill of Bill of Rights?
United Nations, or the League of Nations.
Yeah. Okay, but those are the winners of the war, right? And now none of those were involved in fighting in the city. Yeah. So then, and then they won, and they make the rights. You know, if the other side had won, they would have had a slightly different Bill of Rights. You know. You're not a gypsy, you're not a Jew, you're not this and that, then you have entitled to the rights of life. If you don't meet the criterion, sorry. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So the point is, but where does God come into this? Where does the actual balance? Because the thing is it goes too much one way or the other. You know what I'm saying? The concept is great. The concept of morality, the concept of rights, the concept of all these things are very nice. But why are they very nice? Just because we thought that they were nice? Because if that's all that's dependent on, what happens when we don't think they're nice? Because who's going to enforce it? Us. So if today we think it's great, nice. If we don't, tomorrow we think it's not right, then we have something else altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is no, it's God's laws. So the point is we take part in God's laws, we get the benefit. We don't take part, we'll be punished. Because it's not us who's creating. Because in there, it's not a matter of God. Right? The Constitution, American, that has some element of God. But in this, it's purely secular. You know, so it's just, we'll do this. We think this is right, and we'll take care of this. And what happens when you don't take care of it? You know, and then how do you define education? You know, how do you define health?
Mm-hmm.
How do you define these things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who defines what is healthy? Is 9% body fat healthy? You know what I'm saying? It means the strongest people who actually can physically do something with their strength don't have 9% body fat. They all have up in 20-30%. So, but it's been defined at 9%, now you're healthy. Right? I mean, does that make sense? You can see the abs, okay? But point is but those abs can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's the whole point, is that who's defining health? Who's defining the social interaction? Who's defining the rights? So now they've done that, it sounds great. Yeah, everybody should be educated, but educated in what?
Mm-hmm.
The guy is a carpenter. He wants to be a carpenter. But in America, can he at 6 years old or 12 years old learn carpentry? No. So where's his rights of education? He has to learn what everybody else is learning, and he'll fail. So all your agenda says, everybody has the right to fail. But even that, it's not, because the smart kids who's been, actually for the medium kids, they'll go through okay. The smart kids, it's also boring, because, you know, it's just repeating the same old stuff, the useless stuff, and that they figured out already by 6th grade. And then they got to go through another 6 years of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just their essay writing improves, that's about it. You know, so then, what is this? You know, but it sounds great. Everybody has a right to education and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean? Educate, but according to their nature. Then who defines nature?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, you know, Japanese, they would put the kshatriyas on the top. The vaishyas, farmers, you know, and then vaishyas are on the bottom. And on the bottom of the vaishyas are businessmen. So in their opinion, people who did trade, they're basically pond scum. The lowest of the low. You can't trust them, nothing. They're the worst. Right? And then below the samurais, then you have your Brahmins, your intellectuals. Right? So they have a hierarchy, but why would you put it together like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like that. So it has a thing, but then it's speculative, how you define it.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that here is that since Krishna's entered into everything and he's making everything attractive, then wouldn't we want to have the decision based something on what he is? How is he in that? Okay, we say the rights, but how is he there? What are the elements that we're dealing with?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what we're discussing here is the science, not just some romantic feelings, some idealism. We're talking about now if you can combine science with idealism. Now that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just idealism or just science, then, you know, one's sentimental and one's dry.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be combined. But all this, they get out there and yell and scream, but then you change something and nobody yells and screams anymore. Nobody cares. You know, everyone's there, rah, rah, yeah, America, go, and then they go into Iraq and then nobody cares. Right? But when they were in Afghanistan, everybody was there. Yeah, you know, like that. So it changes like that in one day. So how can you say that this is a safe environment for people to, you know, live in and raise their families in? If it just takes one day to change the whole value system. So that's why you have to base it on something eternal. Then people can feel safe because they know it's always going to be like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing. So what we're saying here is that all these elements means, is there something in the Western culture outside of Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha? Dharma, everyone has a duty, but doesn't everybody have the duty in the Western thing? You work in an office. What does that mean? This is your duty. You get up in the morning, you have your coffee, you get in your car, you ride 2 hours to work. Right? You get there, you sit in a little cubicle and basically do nothing, play games and do a little email, unless, you know, of course, the boss walks by. Right? 5 o'clock, then you go home, 2 hours again in traffic, then when you get home, and then, you know, then you have to interact with your family. You would rather sit on the couch. Right? What's that? Does that make sense? Okay, that's your duty. So the whole point is they have already worked out what everybody does. But it's not scientific. You know what I'm saying? Like that. There is no concept of how it connects to the Lord in that. And then economics. Okay, yeah, economics is there. Judicial system is there. But who judges what's right and wrong? It's just what they kind of, whoever won. You know, in the court. Whatever lawyer made the better presentation, that's all. Who is more clever, that's all. Mm-hmm. That's the judicial system. Shouldn't it be that there's an absolute truth and you judge by that? Or it's just by who's ever a clever, you know, in other words, this rhetoric decides your life, not actual law.
Or which side has more money.
Yeah, who has more money, you get the better lawyer because he's a better at rhetoric. Mm. You know, he has a better plan.
And drag it out.
Yeah, that he knows how to bring up something that throws it out, and then because of that it's reversed, and second he can't bring it up again, and like this, you know. So all these things, and then economics, that we're in a recession, a world recession. That means a lot of people don't know what they're doing. Okay, you can understand, okay, one country's in recession, or a couple of countries, or a region, but the whole world? You know? And then morality is the same. You know, it's just like this. It's between one house and the next, they fight over what's moral. You know? Can the kids just go out and hang out with each other? Or do they have to be regulated in some way? You know? But from individual to individual, community to community, there's different values on that. So where's the common ground? So it's not even that you even have a good solid thing. And when it comes to sense gratification, then are they that good at it? You know what I'm saying? What's so refined about a burger? You know what I'm saying? You know, say, you know, where is this, you know, what is the sense gratification? Right? Does that make sense? You know, and they're complaining about India and sense gratification, but we do have to remember that all the fine spices and scents and many of the things that are in modern perfumes are there from originally from the Indian perfumes. Right? Like that. Like Kus and Chandan. These are all used in the modern ones. Right? They give them different names. You know, but it's just like that. It means, and the West has a book on sex? Or does India have a book on sex? You know what I'm saying? So, if we just look at it, who has, and then when it comes to, then that's those three. Now, what about moksha? Does the West have anything on moksha? Do they even know what the soul is? Can they define it? You know what I'm saying? So that means on moksha and kama, India outstrips the West, you know, 1,000 to 1. You know? And if you look at it, when the Indian businessman actually does know the language and does know how to interact with the Westerners, he does way better on the average than your average Westerner. You know? Mm-hmm. Like that. So the point is what is this inferiorness? What is the superiorness of the other? The point is it's connected to God, it works. Although it is connected to God, it's just a matter of whether you realize it. When you see how it's connected to God, and you therefore you can understand its science, its mechanics, you can get much more out of it. Like if you know how a machine really works and what it can do and its capacity, you get much more out of it than if you have no idea and you're just speculating. Okay, the blender's here and all that. Yeah, but I need some iron filings, you know, for doing some work in the back. So I wonder if it'll grind up iron, you know? So, you know, you can test. But, you know, you may not be able to do much more testing with that particular blender, you know? So it's pretty hit and miss, you know? But if you know that it doesn't, it only does vegetables and stuff like that, okay, then we can use something else. That makes sense? So in other words, the Western, in the modern kind of sense, has been speculating for the last 1,000 years. And it's not that it's improved. You know what I'm saying? You know, India always had the concept of soap. You know? Europe only figured it out, you know, somewhere near the end of the bubonic plague. Right? You know, I saw one documentary, and the whole point of it was the problem of the plague was solved when they figured out by taking a bath you didn't get the plague. You know, it was, he said, so a bar of soap saved the world, right? You know. You know, so that's the wild. And then we're saying this is the superior culture, this is the superior position. It's because of that, that's why you had to have the Magna Carta. You had a bunch of tribals who would do anything to anybody to get anything, whatever they wanted. So you have to make the Magna Carta. You know, you have to make the Universal Bill of Rights. Because otherwise, they'll kill each other. You know what I'm saying? You leave Lord and the Flies there long enough, and then they'll come up with a Bill of Rights. Yeah, they will. You know, it just may take them 1,000 years to work it out. You know? So that's the problem, is that there's so much pride in it. It is correct, yes. But not on its own. You know? It is correct, but it's not on its own. It has to be used properly. Mm-hmm. It has to have the right basis. So that's what we're talking about. So here, what he's bringing out in this philosophy is, if you don't see it in connection with Krishna, that's Vigyan, the second verse, you don't see it in Krishna, it is illusion. You can say, we can connect it to Krishna, but is it? How are you connecting it? But why would you connect it to Krishna? Right? Because as we saw before, in the theistic moralist, he says, God is the creator, I am the created. Right? God is the bestower, I'm the one who gets everything bestowed upon. Mm-hmm. Right? He is great, I am small. But is there any connection to God other than you just recognize? It's a step, of course, that we consider it a good step. Mm-hmm. But where's the devotion? So therefore, if a devotee only applies that much, the theistic moralism, then is it actually an improvement? Dropping from the fifth to the third level of consciousness, is that an improvement? And if they say, no, but devotees aren't behaving properly with each other, great. But what would that introduce it? That Vaishnava, Lord Chaitanya says, you're not going back to Godhead without Vaishnava etiquette. So therefore, it's an important thing. And if you don't have Vaishnava etiquette, all these problems come. You have it, these problems won't come. So it's not a matter about rights, it's a matter about etiquette. I guess they sang the song right.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes?
No.
Yes. Yes. Is that okay?
Thank you.
In other words, those things are, they're all, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out, they're all noble efforts, but they're always incomplete because they're not connected to the Lord. So the connection to the Lord is what gives them value. But if people are opposed to that, then they'll always have to make do with, you know, second verse, best, third best, tenth best. But by connecting to the Lord, then you don't have that problem. Right? But it's not whimsical how you connect it. There's a science.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
Okay. says when those spiritual activities reach completeness and perfection, even the spiritual activities are reaching perfection. It means they're already perfect, but they're reaching more perfect, most perfect. And what's the difference? How much is centered on yourself? How much is centered on the Lord? Right? So therefore, the step that you're shifting is the focus from myself to others, that's a positive step forward. But until it gets to God, it's not complete. Right? It's not about me. Complete is about God. But it's not about me. It's about my, you know, family or my friends or my country. It's a step forward, but it's not complete. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Everybody has their rights. Okay, that's a step forward rather than just where's my rights. Mm-hmm. Right? That's great. But the point is how do you define rights? How do I define, you know, who's you know, the kid, he wants to doodle. Right? And the teacher wants him to learn. Mm-hmm. So how do you define the rights and obligations there? He really sincerely wants to carve his name and the girl at two desks over into the top of his desk. He really sincerely wants to do that as an expression of pure love. But that desk belongs to the government, and so it's the people's desk. Does he have a right to carve it there? So how do you balance between the people's rights and his individual right? Right? That makes sense. You know, if he really wants to do it, get a tattoo. You know, leave the desk alone.
To bring one on the desk.
Yeah, he can bring his own desk and carve it. So he can have a desk in the back. It's the student's desk, and they can carve all their names in it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So that's the problem. How do you define that? So then the Shastra is defined. Then it's...
I was just thinking... The graffiti artist is a criminal, but the company can advertise as many billboards as they want. So we're not
thinking. Yeah. Yeah, because he can afford it. Yeah. Now, what happens, now, would it be considered graffiti if he bought the space? You know? I think there's one on the... I'm not sure what it is, but it's... I think it's on... No, it's not first. Maybe on Houston? Mm-hmm. Like that, I think just before first or just after first, and it's like there's this, like three-story building, just on the edge and partially sticks out, and it's got this huge painting on it. Mm-hmm. You know that one? Mm-hmm. You walk by it.
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, so, you know, whether that was supposed to be there or not, but because the artistic area that it probably looks like, it's cool, yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. Who defines it? Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Because otherwise, then who has the right to define it? That's the difficulty. So if God doesn't have the right, then it's anybody else's. You know, it's speculative. Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's so many religions. So Christians will say it is what God wants. The Jews will say it is what. So we should decide ourselves because.
But how can you decide yourself? That's just like, well, my mother says this, my father says that, so I just have to decide for myself, you know? Like that.
Someone's got to decide.
Yeah, so therefore, you know, 10 cookies before dinner, you know? That's what I've decided, hey, you know?
But that's what democracy is for, consensus building.
Consensus. Now, that's if you can get them to turn out, you know? It is for consensus building, but why? In other words, at what level do you have to have consensus? Means, in other words, there's a level where consensus is the natural, nice level, but there's a level at where people feel insecure without consensus. Mm-hmm. Where does that come in? Because in the Vedic system, democracy is a major part of the system. Mm-hmm. But it's the village part of the system. Because the villagers, because of their material attachment and their bodily identification, they feel if I'm not involved in the process, then, you know, I'm not represented. Mm-hmm. Because they don't really have that trust. Mm-hmm. Right? So in other words, the village council, the panchayat, it's a Vedic thing. Mm-hmm. is made up of these particular kinds of people that represent everything. And then, you know, amongst people, they elect a leader, a village leader. It's by their vote. It doesn't necessarily have to be in that form, but it's they've decided this person is going to do it. Then he represents his village, you know, with 10 other villages. And then there's amongst those 10, one is head. And then 10 of those, one's head. 10 of those. So however big the country is, then there'll be that many layers before it gets to the, you know, central government. Right? When it gets to the central government, then all the different regions and that are all represented there. So they say what's going on in the places, what people need, what's happening, and this and that. So the government is actually informed of what's going on down at the village level. But that's all the higher that system gets. So there's no need of politicking. Right? And it is it means it is elected, so therefore you don't represent, they don't elect you again. So it is very practical at that point. But on how the country actually runs, it's not the people. How would they know? That's why they're the citizens. The government knows how to run things. That's why at that point now the government makes the decision on what should be done, not the democratic element. But the democratic element represents the people and what's happening and what their needs are. But taking care of those needs, that what the government does. Because this system, you know, where does it get its stuff from? Right? Because if you put it together and they take taxes amongst themselves, who knows how to do that? The government is people who know how to do it. Therefore, the tax goes to the government. The government affects it. So you have this democracy and monarchy working together, not that this puppet kind of thing, the monarch just sits there and the democracy runs everything. It works both together. They work simultaneously, parallel. Mm-hmm. Like that. And but then how do you, the kshatriyas know what they're doing because the Brahmins give them direction and training. Mm-hmm. But it's their decision. It's not that the Brahmins run it. You know what I'm saying? So you have to have all these elements. Mm-hmm. That's a complete system. So trying to run it just off of one, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You had something?
Democracy doesn't really represent the people like the way it is. I don't know about America's system, but in Australia, I mean, the majority party has maybe a 2-seat majority, so that means half the, you know, the country is not being represented at all. So it's, I mean, and you only have a choice out of like a couple of people that you don't necessarily agree with their values. So.
No, you have a yob or you have a boyo. You can vote for either one. Right? Did I say it correctly?
I didn't catch the second one.
Boyo?
Boyo.
That's where it originally comes from. Cockney, where you have a boy, he's a boyo. Okay. And if you pronounce boy backwards, that's a yob. So you've heard about in other words, I guess the boyo didn't make it over to that side. Yeah. Like that. The yob did. Like that. So. The boyo is the guy with the bobber boots.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Does that put it in perspective now? Okay. Okay, so then text 8. Chintati tam idam tattvam dvaita dvaita surupakam chaitanya charanash svadach Chuda jive patiyate. The supreme truth, who is different and non-different from everything, cannot be known by the material mind. Only the pure souls who taste the sweet nectar of taking shelter of Lord Chaitanya's feet have the power to know the supreme truth. So then you even see here is that taking shelter of Lord Chaitanya, then this Achinta Bheda Bheda philosophy can be appreciated. And appreciating that, then you can actually appreciate the sweetness of Krishna. mm-hmm. in Vrindavan, because that's the complete manifestation of the philosophy, because that's what the complete personality of Godhead, the supreme personality of Godhead. When you're dealing with parts of the philosophy, then you're dealing with, because it means it's an expansion, you're dealing with the expansions of the Lord. Right? So, does that make sense? So for the devotee, because he knows the complete, therefore even dealing with the expansions, he sees it as a connection with the complete. You know, does that make sense? It's Krishna. You know, therefore you see the paintings that, you know, it has Nisringadeva, but he's wearing a peacock feather. Why? Because it's Keshava Drita Nadahari Rupa. Krishna's come as Nisringadeva. Does that make sense? You know, but for others, then it's just Nisringadeva, because you know that much, you know that part of the philosophy, so he's just Nisringadeva. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. The material mind has no power to understand how the Supreme can be both different and not different from everything. Why not? Because in the material world, no one sees mutually contradictory qualities residing in the same place. Therefore, the soul is imprisoned in the material world. Souls whose knowledge is only of material things will not be inclined to believe that mutually contradictory qualities exist in Bhagavan, manifest by his inconceivable potencies. Numberless mutually contradictory qualities happily and gracefully reside in Bhagavan. Because everything's coming from him. So his potencies are harmonious, because they come from him. So then all these contradictory elements are harmoniously reposed in him. Right? It's not that there's a problem. We just see the external, so there's a difference between this and that. But on the spiritual platform, it's not a problem, because all the energies are all working together. Ultimately, there's one energy, the Surup Shakti.
Maharaj, Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva is also falling into this explanation.
No, this is explaining Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva. So in other words, he did the generic kind of Vaikuntha flavor, but now he's focusing on Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva. Right? So in other words, you have that basis. Because even if you take, then if we're going to take Vox Populi, even here, if we value Vox Populi, Goloka is 51%, Vaikuntha is 49%. Okay? So, Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva wins. Okay?
So this concept is...
If you don't believe in that, then the people of Vaikuntha are happy there, and the people in Goloka are happy there, so no one, there's no problem.
I'm trying to understand this concept is applicable only in the material sphere or...
Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva. No, that was explained before. Yeah. That's what how it works in the spiritual world. Okay. No, I'm sorry. It means everything is... All these contradictory elements are all perfectly aligned in Krishna. Right? Because he's one with but different from. Means, why does Mother Yashoda think that Krishna is her child? Because of the difference or the oneness? Because of the difference. But, you know, the cow is also different. Right? So it's the peacock out in the backyard. So that makes them all Mother Yashoda's child.
I think I can.
Well, I'll give you a hint. There's only one other answer. And it's not a trick question.
Oneness.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. So she sees the oneness there of Krishna and herself. But at the same time, it's to interact with Krishna. It means, in other words, the feeling is oneness. My son. But the interaction is, there's two. So this oneness and difference is the principle in which rasa works. But as I said, so oneness and difference is how the whole cosmic creation functions, just people don't realize that this is what it's working on. This is the bottom underlying, you know, element of the philosophy. That's why Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva is not just another philosophy, it's the philosophy that can reconcile any problem in any other philosophy. Because all the philosophies you only take part, they work. Because they're all connected to Krishna, but there's some area where it doesn't apply so well. But that area is not where they're trying to apply it. You know what I'm saying? So it's like Madhva, he's talking about there's God and there's us. We're servant, he's the Lord. He's the supreme, we're the servant. So that works here to get us, okay, I'm not God, he's God. Okay, and you know, all this opulence is to use for God. When you get to the spiritual world, it still works. Right? Ramanuja is talking about, you know, God is there, we're here as parts and parcels. So therefore, that flavor between God and us, that we're his servants and that mood, then that works here and it works there. You know what I'm saying? But the problem is then when it comes to explaining elements of the difference, Ramanuja's philosophy won't be strong. When it comes to explaining the sameness, Madhva's won't be strong. But because of a Chintabheda Tattva, it still works. So the powering principle is a Chintabheda Veda Tattva. But they're only focusing on one part of it. But it works because of that bigger. Because Madhva does refer to in the spiritual world about the oneness of the mood of the devotees, but in the material world he doesn't bring it up at all. You know? And Ramanuja will mention about the difference between God and the living entity, but that's not the focus. Does that make sense? Yeah. So Achintabheda Veda Tattva is alluded to, but not necessarily fully understood.
So this is a kind of highest secret, confidential knowledge that is revealed.
That's why he said it's rahasya. Mm-hmm. It's how he's one with but different from everything.
But so Parama,
the point is that can't be understood by the material mind. It's only by the grace of the Lord coming through the parampara that it can be appreciated. Yeah. He is the formless Brahman, and he is also a person with sublimely graceful form. He is smaller than the smallest and larger than the largest. He is impartial, but he still loves his devotees. He has no qualities, but then again, he certainly does have qualities. He is the impersonal Brahman, and he is also Krishna surrounded by many cowherd boyfriends. He is the greatest philosopher, full of knowledge, and he is also a lover. His whole being made of love. Because generally you don't put the two together. Big philosophers aren't greatly known for their romantic side, you know, like that. And the romantics aren't generally known for having much philosophy, right? You know, other than like he who dares wins, you know. But even that, I don't think they take it that far intellectually to even think that, right? That's just crazy. Bhagavan is the shelter where these and all other mutually contradictory qualities reside. Right, so this and more. So it's unlimited. It's all contradictory. The Lord cannot be compared to material things. The soul imprisoned in the material world possesses intelligence made of matter. That material intelligence has no power to touch what is beyond the world of matter. For this reason, the souls imprisoned in the world of matter cannot understand the qualities of Bhagavan. Because the qualities of Bhagavan are transcendental, and you're trying to use a machine that's material. You can't understand transcendence from material machinery. That's the... As long as they remain in the prison... Oh, okay. In this way, they do not believe that Bhagavan's nature is like that. So therefore they deify him and just, you know, kind of make him a bit impotent. And then somehow they're very satisfied that they've done a great job, right? As long as they remain in the prison of the material world, the individual spirit souls cannot understand how Bhagavan is simultaneously one and different from everything. Will the souls imprisoned in matter never understand this point? The answer is that the souls who taste the nectar of devotional service to Lord Chaitanya's feet will gradually become purified. In this way, they will eventually be able to understand it. As he becomes purified, the soul realizes his original nature, because that original nature is inherent in the soul. That's just who he is. Right? And then by Lord Chaitanya's grace, he can understand this fullness of the Achintabheda Veda Tattva. Then he understands how Bhagavan is simultaneously one and different. Here, the phrase Chaitanya Charanashvadat has two meanings. Although, in truth, the two meanings are actually one. One meaning is, by serving Lord Chaitanya's feet, one attains transcendental bliss. The second meaning is by serving the feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who knows everything, one attains transcendental bliss. Lord Chaitanya is not different from the all-knowing Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the two meanings are actually one. In the first part of this book, were considered the opinions of different philosophers. Philosophers who are all individual spirit souls imprisoned in the material world. Now that I have refuted all their philosophies, I will describe the supreme spiritual truth, the truth taught by supremely pure Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chideva param tattvam, chideva parameshvara, chit kano jiva eva sau, visheshas chit vichit durata. The supreme truth is spiritual. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is spiritual. The individual spirit soul is a tiny particle of spirit. Great variety exists in the realm of spirit. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Spirit, matter, and the individual spirit souls are the three divisions of existence. The supreme truth is spiritual. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is spiritual. The individual spirit soul is a tiny particle of spirit. Great variety exists in the realm of spirit. Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is like a sun shining in the spiritual world. The particles of light emanating from that sun are the individual spirit souls. Thus, the individual souls are tiny particles of spirit. Great variety exists in the realm of spirit. Nothing is superior to spirit. The variety present in the material world is only a reflection of the variety in the spiritual world. Right. And you see, you don't get all the things. Like you can say, no, but it would be the same. It's similar, just like your arm in the mirror is similar. But is there the other side of the arm? No. It's not. You can only see the one side. So its variety is limited. Mm-hmm. Right? There's no touch. There's no taste, no smell. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right? You know, there's no sound, there's only the sight, only one is there. So one out of five is there. Mm-hmm. Plus, what you're getting there is only a 2D view of it. So that's the material world. You're only getting a portion of the experience of that is there in the spiritual world. So, point is, everything is spirit. So here we're saying spirit, so think the spiritual, it's spirit. Right? So then there's a lot of variety. So within all these, here you have the main spirit, matter, and individual spirit souls. So spirit here means the Lord and everything. So in this, we're not counting material as Brahman, right? Because now we're talking about the conscious element and the interaction, the rasa aspect. Right? Riti. The following passage from Chaitanya Shikshamrita elaborates on the concept of spiritual variety. Quote, those people who reject the material world but cannot conceive of a superior realm imagine an existence without distinctions, nirvisesha. Without thinking deeply, they conclude that the higher existence must be the total opposite of everything in the material world. In the material world, there is form, change, qualities, distinctions, images, action, plurality. The higher realm must have no form, no change, no qualities, no distinction, no images, no action, no plurality. But this conclusion is only a logical creation, and logic is born from the material world. If logic is stretched to the extreme, it can imagine an opposite condition to that presently existing. Therefore, this logical conclusion is but a type of fantasy with no substance. It's just they're complaining that the romantic is fantasizing how nice the material world will be, and they're being realistic that it's not. But then they're fantasizing what the alternative is, mm-hmm. right? And but people aren't obtaining it. So in the reality, one stays here. Mm-hmm. It is not arrived at by spiritual realization, even by logic. What are the characteristics of a substance and its opposite? Logic, if unbiased, will say that a non-substance has no existence, and substance has existence, right? Because they're taking it that's the substance, this is not. But the point is something without substance has no form, and something with substance does, so it should be the opposite. Right? Logic, if unbiased, will say, okay, if the world being illusory is a non-substance, then all conclusion in relation to it or biased upon it are also false. if the world has substance, then it must have qualities. So in other words, if this is an illusion, then how would the substance being the opposite, the having the form, if this is an illusion, then that means that should have a real form. But if you're basing it on this, then how do you understand? Right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So if the world has, but if this world is real, it has substance, therefore there's qualities, therefore then there must be the original qualities. Does that work?
Mm-hmm.
What are the qualities of a substance? It has existence. Ashitva, distinctness. Visesha, action. Kriya, and use, prayojana. Yeah, so here as we say, existence, how it fits into the thing, distinction, you know, its particular uniqueness and how it functions in that, action, how it will be applied, and prayojana of what result you get. So do we see what we're dealing with here?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Means existence and distinctness is sambandha, action is abhideya, and use is prayojana, right? So that means the asitva, its existence, that Shankarshan, and the distinctions, Vishesha, that's Pajumna. You see how that's working?
This is the distinctiveness, the distinctive qualities of something.
That's what you're attracted to. Yeah, then you desire, because when I see that this distinctly can do this, this can get that result, I am inspired to want it. Right? And then by contemplating, then that becomes a need, because want and need are two different things. Right? Want, if it's contemplated long enough, becomes need, but it's not automatic. Like that. You have to cultivate it to become need. If it has no existence, non-existence negates the object. If the object has no distinctness, the object can exist, not exist as an independent object. If the object has no action or effect, with no reference, it must be an illusion. If it has no use or function, except it has has no function, use or function, to accept it as real is useless. Right? So therefore, if you take Nir Guna Brahman, it doesn't have any of this. Right? Because its existence, you're saying there is nothing, so it actually doesn't exist. They'll say it exists, so if it exists, that's a quality. It has a substance, there's existence. But Brahman is Nir Vishesh, it has no quality, so therefore it can't exist.
Non-substance.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's distinct. You can say, no, there's a material world, then there's Brahman. That's distinctness. But then that means it's an object. Right? So that's a quality.
Mm-hmm.
An action, I will, through knowledge, then negate the material, my connection or identification with the material, then I'll again, then prayojana, merge back into the material, into the spirit. But I'm using my material intelligence to do that. So how would material intelligence get you to spirit, you know, especially if it doesn't exist at all, you know? And if this exists, so in other words, if this doesn't exist, what's the use of using a portion of this illusion to get you out of illusion? Right?
Mm-hmm.
The same time is, if it is substance, then the thing is then that means Brahman has to have substance, so that means it has to have qualities. So if you say it has no qualities, then that's the thing with no substance, so that's the illusion. So Nirvishesh Brahman is actually, that's the illusion. The material world exists, it's substance. But the problem is not seeing its connection with Saguna Brahman, that's what the illusion is. Right? Illusion is, I don't see the connection with the material world and Saguna Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's what the illusion is. And then, so that's the karma side. The gyan side of this illusion is to think that substance is Nirguna Brahman. So again, you don't see, again, our definition holds that illusion is not seeing the connection with things and Saguna Brahman. So if you don't see Nirguna Brahman in connection with Saguna, it's still illusion. Just now you're a jnani instead of a karmi. Right? What was that original thing you were saying? Achinta Veda Veda Tattva, those two aspects.
Anvaya Vyati Reka. Direct and indirect.
Okay, yes. So the direct, then we see the direct.
Mm-hmm.
but we don't see a connection to the Lord, so you get karma. Mm-hmm. And we see the indirect, but we don't see a connection with the Lord, so we get jnana. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the Lord is Saguna Brahman. There is no such thing as nirguna. Right? I mean, it's nirguna meaning not material there is, but nirguna meaning in the ultimate sense there isn't, that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Illusion is like made of karma and jnana.
Illusion gives the effect of karma and jnana. Illusion just means you don't see its connection with the Lord. You don't see it what it is. Maya means that which is not. You think this is something to enjoy, or this is something not to enjoy. You know, for me, the point is no, this is something for Krishna to enjoy, or this is not a situation for Krishna to enjoy. It's not about me. It's about Krishna. Okay. If the object has no action or effect with no reference, it must be an illusion. If it has no use or function, to accept it as real is useless. The higher realm must be called a real object or substance with existence, distinction, action, and function. The person asks what proof is there that the opposite of the material world is a real substance. Then he defeats his own conclusion, which is based on logic. Right? Because he said that if it's opposite, right? He says, what is it? What is the proof that there is the opposite of the material world is a real substance? But his whole philosophy is that spirit, the transcendence is the opposite of the material. And if the material is illusion, then what's spiritual? It must be substance. The substance has this definition.
Right. Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They're just so clever, the acharyas.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
To claim that the higher realm must be opposite brings about an imperfect conclusion, for whether an opposite substance exists or not is not known to all. To accept it, one would have to use the logic of a drunk man. To conceive of a world unlike this world by ascribing qualities devoid of material imperfection, however, is not wrong. Right? In other words, it doesn't have any of these material qualities. That's the actual understanding of nirguna. It means nirguna simply means it doesn't have material qualities, it has spiritual qualities. Right? So, in other words, parts of their philosophy are correct, but the problem is how they put it together is wrong. It's incomplete, because they don't accept the Lord. Right? Or they misunderstand or misinterpret or misapply their elements that are correct. Mm-hmm. Though the material organ of reasoning cannot know the existence of anything beyond matter, the perceptual organ of the soul, whose medium is pure knowledge and which manifests in the pure condition of the soul, can know to some exist the existence, distinction, action, and function of the spiritual realm. If existence, distinction, action, and function do not exist in the spiritual realm, then no spiritual world exists. If those fond of logic give up prejudice and consider impartially the subject, they can understand these matters. Right? So in other words, they're using logic, but they're saying that they're unbiased, but actually they're quite biased. That's the difficulty. Mm. Because they're not willing to accept that there is the Supreme. Mm. Because point is this not means, why is it that means if the Supreme is beyond, why is it that it has to, yes, it has to not have material qualities, that's fine, we'll agree with that. But why does it have to mean that there is no substance? Why is there's no form? There's no action, right? There's, you know, how is that there's no result? How will it say that? Because even if they talk about it, they talk about Brahmananda, the happiness there, so they're talking about a result. So they talk about it in means of substance, but by their own definition, that their definitions of substance are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't exist. There is no distinction. Text 10. Anandas chad chid gunah prokta savai vriti swarupaka yasyanu shila shilan naj jiva parananda stitim labhe. Spirit is by nature full of bliss. By performing spiritual activities, one becomes blissful. commentary by Srimad Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Free will is the one is one quality of spirit, and bliss is another quality of spirit. Bliss is part of the nature of spirit. Therefore, by again and again performing spiritual activities, the individual soul becomes blissful. In the Vedas it is said, Esha Hinandayati. When one understands the personality of Godhead, this reservoir of pleasure, Krishna, he actually becomes transcendentally blissful. In this way, the Vedas affirm that bliss is part of the spirit, nature of spirit. It has the power to burn, so that means there's visesha, there's distinctness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It means there's existence of this, you know, the transcendental realm, there's bliss. Right? And that bliss is what people are trying to gain. So that means, therefore, those there must be a process.
Mm-hmm.
As the power to burn is part of the nature of fire, and as fluidity is part of the nature of water, so bliss is part of the nature of spirit.
Mm.
Even souls imprisoned by matter enjoy a certain material vision, version of that bliss. Everything has two features. One feature is its nature, and the other is its activities, right? Because that's what we're saying, that's in that philosophical element, that's your formal cause.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It means you have the quality upon which everything is based, right? Because that's the masculine principle. The feminine principle is the nature and its activities, right? So that makes the formal cause. That's what's reflected into the material world. So the forms and activities here are a reflection of the spiritual nature and activities. And to make it actually function, then as Krishna is the potency there, Krishna is the potency here. But the problem is you think it's that form and all that is actually not that, it's the potency behind it. The original cause is actually what you're looking for. Right? The activity of spirit brings spiritual bliss. A soul who again and again engages in blissful spiritual activities eventually attains spiritual bliss, gradually becomes qualified to enjoy the bliss of personal association with Bhagavan. Right? So now, here also, then we can see the others, what he was mentioning before. Because here's just a philosophical presentation. But here we can see what was discussed in other parts was spiritual activities bring spiritual bliss. Right? So in other words, you do spiritual activities, no matter who you are, you get some happiness from that. That's why devotees continue doing the activity, because it gives them some spiritual bliss. Right? Then, so again and again engages in blissful spiritual activities, eventually attains spiritual bliss. Okay? Now, if you just ended there, then you would say that you attain spiritual bliss, so the whole process is complete. But he's continued, gradually becomes qualified to enjoy the bliss of personal association with Bhagavan. So here when it says, eventually attains spiritual bliss, what was he talking about here?
Brahmananda.
Yeah, Brahmananda, or you can say, but for the devotee, what's that platform of Brahmananda?
Bhava,
right? Right? That's the position on where you're spiritually situated, you're tasting spiritual bliss, therefore it's bhava, it's ecstasy. But then by that you gradually get qualified to attain the personal association with the Lord. So that means that then even that spiritual bliss is even more, because that's prema. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, the culture is always based on the philosophy. The philosophy always contains the culture. They contain each other. They're non-different, right? So they're two different aspects of the same thing. You know, same, just like Krishna. Krishna's energies are non-different, but at the same time different. So philosophy and religion are different, but at the same time is they're non-different. Right? So it's kind of useless to say that you can do one without the other. You know, just like, you know, that question, when will the mind be, you know, pulled away from the senses and the sense object and this way become peaceful? That can't happen. Mind means it interacts with the senses and sense objects. What you can do is pull it away from the material concept that there's something to enjoy here and apply it into the spiritual. right? That you can do with the mind, but you can't separate. So you can say, you can't separate philosophy and religion or the culture. You can try, but it, you can't actually. Like that. You know, it's just like, let's say, the modern culture means its philosophy is basically, how you say? You can say it's the combination between the atheistic and moralist and the atheistic moralist. Right? Means the actual culture, the secular culture, like that. Because how it means you have to be able to cooperate together, but that's not what you could promote. You promote what you'll get out of it yourself. Therefore, the people work very hard. If there's some little weakness in the system, then you start promoting the working together. Right? But because of this interesting philosophical combination, that's why the modern materialist gets bewildered on why is it that, you know, it's so clear we're supposed to work together and that way we'll be able to individually enjoy. But the people can't make that balance. Right? They can't actually function as a atheistic moralist. Because the advertisement on the billboard is that about being an atheistic moralist, cooperating together, is about you, what you're going to get out of yourself. So the billboard says atheistic moralism. Right? Everything is all about, all enjoyment is about atheistic moralism. So then one becomes bewildered why people take up atheistic moralism. Why won't they stick to the path of theistic moralism? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's just like, let us say, or I can just give examples. Let's say, advertisement for a resort. Now, if you go back some time, you know, the old advertisements, it would show happy families in nice situations with other happy families. So it was, you know, all so many people in a place enjoying like anything, right? The modern ones, what I've seen, the more recent, is you focus in on one individual. You're at the resort, and there's the wife at the spa, you know, there with the hot, you know, rock sitting on her back. You know, and the guy's doing something else on his own. So it's all about what you're going to get out of it. Not that, you know, everybody together and everything like that. You know? I guess that's why people don't go to the Catskills so much anymore, right? Does that make sense? So it's changed, and then they're wondering why people are so self-centered and so crazy. You know, it's because of the philosophy. So you can't separate the two. But they're thinking, no, we will get gross sense gratification and maintain this romantic, you know, interactive, everybody lovey-dovey working together. You know? So that's the problem.
Right. So what's better? A person has a manufactured idea of religion, or a very weird idea of religion, or very fanatical idea of religion.
Are you giving three? Is that three separate options? Or are you making that as one option?
Generally, they end up as one, but either or. And wouldn't it be better they're atheists? As for society and as individuals, would they be work better in society and be nicer people?
Yes, they would. But that's the point, is that that is the basis, but that's not how they're advertising. That's not how they're motivating their economic system to work. Right? Means the Vedic is you're motivating it on actual need. But in the modern, you just create desire. You know, turn that into need. But it's self-centered rather than the community or what's good for the family. Or, you know what I'm saying? That's the difference. It's not about those universal elements of, you know, cooperation. It's about the individual sense gratification. You know, no, it's just, you know, it means, does that make sense? You know, it's just
atheist or theist, same thing.
Well, atheistic theist is what you just mentioned.
Yeah, but it seems
they call them pseudo-theistic more or less. Because they look like they're actually theistic, but they're not. So there's a belief in supreme and this and that, but the difference is, if it's real, then it's actually God, and if it's not, then they make up a God. So you do get that. You know, it's just like, you know, so many philosophers, they make up what is supreme. Yeah, you see nature is supreme, or this or that, whatever you like. Their whole point is that you must have an element of supreme, so whatever works for you, then that's good. So that's your pseudo. You know, the other is that, no, there's actually God, and that's the way it is. Like that. But then, what we're saying is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur takes them a step further. Then, having accepted that, okay, there is God and all that, but now how are you actually going to define your moralism? So therefore, because before this, it was speculative, because you didn't really have God. So now, since you're having God, therefore use God's system, use Varnashram, because that will actually define everything. It's God's creation, so this is how God's creation works. So that's the natural step that you take people through, like that, if you're discussing that on that logical element. But it's still not complete until they understand then, but then they have to understand they're the soul. So who are they? Who are they in actually this whole thing? You have your duties, you have this, there's God, there's the soul. So therefore you need the spiritual. So that brings in the moksha aspect. Right? So then they become to, what do you call it? Just impersonalist. Then, but that's not complete till you get it, because the nature of the soul is servant of God, so you have to bring it to the fifth level. So therefore we have to surrender to God as his servant. Then anything looked for in the four lower levels is already included in the fifth. Because the four lower levels are simply the reflection of the fifth. That's all. It's just not clear. It's not complete. So anything anybody's looking for in Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha is found in Bhakti. But they're thinking that they can get it separately. That's the problem. Best of both worlds. But there is no best of both worlds. Right? Because there isn't a best here. Like that. But you know what I'm saying? And at the same time, there's no such thing as something less than best in the spiritual world. You know, because if you say best of both, you're picking the more important. That means there's not something more important in the spiritual world. It's all perfect. So the fallacy doesn't work on either side. But, you know, it's popular. Like that. So, in other words, whatever anybody's looking for is found in devotional service. It's not that devotional service doesn't include it. Well, okay, this is devotional service. Then, because we're working in the material world, we have to have some practical this and that. But that's already there. Devotional service already includes that. If you don't see that, it's just a matter of education. But there's no such thing as the devotional service not including everything. Because the point is God is everything. And you're interacting with everything, you know. So why wouldn't it include everything else? But it includes what's beyond everything else. In other words, everything else plus more. That plus more is that bhakti. Because God is a person beyond it. Because when we're saying, well, we have to be practical in dealing, that you're talking Brahman and Paramatma. So that's already included in Bhagavan. But Bhagavan includes more, that bhakti. So it's just a matter of educating oneself on how it would make it work. Okay. So we'll end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki,
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki,
Jai
Jai Nitya Gaura ki.
Jai.